taking the pulse today on the top news stories this week. I'm Bharati Jagdish. Thanks for joining me. And today, a story that got the most reactions on our online platforms and, of course, in Kopitiams all over Singapore. The budget debate, the various elements, but especially, of course, the impending GST hike. To talk all about this, my guests are Member of Parliament for McPherson, Tin Pei Ling, and Chief Editor of Channel News Asia's Digital News Desk, Jamie Ho. Budget 2018 has been passed in Parliament. Finance Minister Heng Swee Keat has said that by announcing the GST increase early, the government is actually giving ample notice to both ordinary citizens and businesses, and it's being honest and upfront about Singapore's national needs and setting out what needs to be done. Of course, the hike in GST from 7 to 9% is set for some time from 2021 to 2025. But the big question is, are Singaporeans convinced? We're going to be talking about this and other issues that stood out for our guests during the budget debate, what else we can look forward to as well in the next couple of weeks. Now, lots of people still asking if there are other means to finance future needs, higher sin taxes, capital gains taxes, raising the net investment returns contribution to the budget, the reserves. Pei Ling, what's your assessment of the last few days? Have people been convinced through this debate?
Well, I think quite clearly and understandably, Singaporeans are concerned with the impending GST increase because this will affect their livelihood, you know, their cost of living. The pressure is already very high. They're worried. They're not sure how much of an impact it would be in the expected future, but they're definitely concerned and it's going to be painful for them. At the same time, they're also wondering what kind of packages will be available to help them offset, especially for the low income and also certain segments of the middle income because they tend to be sandwiched as well. So a lot of the conversation has been surrounding that. Of course, over the past few days, there has been debate. There has been a lot of explanations set out for the rationale for this particular measure. So I think over time, Singaporeans do come to understand a little bit better why this is the decision made of all the trade-offs that have been considered. However, I think emotionally, it would still be quite challenging for people to overcome. But I think rationally, Singaporeans have a better understanding. And now it's really for the emotions to settle a little bit more. And Singaporeans will then have to think through whether this is the way forward. But I think what is also important for all of us is that at a higher level, we need to be sure of the direction of the country.
Yep.
Because we are faced with a lot of challenges. There's technological disruption around us. If we don't transform in time, then even our very mere survival is being at stake. And then we also have disruptions within our own country. And by that, I do mean, for example, how our population makeup is changing with the aging population. Needs will change. The way we do our policies, the way we do our infrastructure, the way we organize ourselves, all these will also have to change along with it. And of course, with infrastructure, we know that it's also a very big item, mature infrastructure that needs to be maintained, new infrastructure that needs to be built. All these are very high cost and high impact. And
I think people generally do understand that our spending needs are increasing and there is a need to plan for the future. What they don't seem to understand, going by some of the comments that we've been seeing online on our social media platforms, is why does there need to be a GST hike necessarily to finance all of this? These questions are still being asked in spite of the fact that there have been extensive explanations in Parliament. For instance, people are saying, why couldn't the net investment returns contribution to the budget be raised? How much in reserves do we really need? Why can't we use more of our reserves, some of our reserves? Jamie, what have you observed in the last few days as well?
Well, not just this budget, but previous budgets as well. I've always wished that the discussion could be a bit more multifaceted in that we always talk about the impending demands of increasing expenditure and therefore raising revenue to meet these expenditure needs, right? And it's always about spending more. Yes, in this particular budget, there are several headline items, healthcare, infrastructure, transport. But at some point in time, and maybe this will help drive home the trade-offs to the public as well, in that let's also talk about besides that, it's managing expenditure. Because it's not just about raising expenditure, but sometimes, just like any household, when you talk about your budget, yes, you need to spend more. But when the decision time comes, you also have to have some introspection of what do you have to spend less on.
Cost cutting is what we call it.
And then people will realize, okay, if I don't want to raise taxes, if I don't want to talk about raising potential areas of revenue, then the alternative is maybe we need to cut costs somewhere else. So, for example, I need to cut costs in education. I need to cut costs in social spending. Then Singaporeans will maybe think, oh, yes, if I don't want to cut costs there, if I want some more subsidies or I want to maintain subsidies, then it has to come from somewhere else. But the debate now is sort of like you only see half the debate. You don't see the other half of the debate. But once you see as a whole, and I think we should do a little bit more of this as time goes by, then you put the GST increases into context as to what exactly are you funding it for and without having to cut expenditure.
So actually, this is something you brought up in Parliament as well. You said that we need to ensure that ministries and statutory boards are run efficiently before taxes are raised. Make sure the money collected is not squandered. That's a big issue as well. Are the ministries spending money wisely? So expand on that for us, Pei Ling. Clearly, this was a concern for you.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, for me, the finance minister in his statement actually laid out three things, right? One is to make sure that the government spends the money wisely, and that includes cutting the budget growth for each ministry, except for the key ones such as healthcare, as well as the infrastructure and education, of course. So that's one. And then secondly is, of course, the borrowing to fund some of the big infrastructure items. And then the third one was GST. And I think we should be doing it in that order because Singaporeans have trusted us and we must not let them down. So for the first point about managing costs, I think government agencies will have to do its best to make sure that they look into ways to make sure that the processes are efficient, the way they call for tenders, all of this, that it's value for money. And that
with greater technological advancements,
yes,
also, things should get a little leaner, right?
It should. And I think...
But there needs to be an upfront investment in the technological
Certainly, but
aspect.
We should look at the lifetime savings as well and the cost avoided. So I think, I believe a finance minister did say that during the MOF, COS, more will be shared. So we're looking forward to that. So that one, I think, is something that we must look forward to. However, exactly how much cost we can save from these, it is still, I think, something that we don't have great clarity yet. But I think overall, one thing is that, as what Jamie has pointed out, I think as a society, as a whole nation, we need to decide on if we are looking at not just raising revenue to meet the increased expected needs, then what else are we prepared to cut back on, and are we prepared to live with that consequence? So it could be as simple as every day in our community, whether we are willing to trade off, for example, maybe build one less walkway versus another program, for example.
Or get less in terms of housing subsidies.
Exactly. So you look at all the list of all the social transfers that actually people benefit from and have a really hard analysis of each and every single one and then decide, okay, I think this one maybe we can do less of. Because, for example, education. I'm not sure whether people do know that after you include EduSave and stuff like that, if a kid goes to a regular government school, his school fees are effectively free.
Yes.
You don't actually pay for anything once, even with the very... low school fees and miscellaneous fees.
And there's no GST.
You effectively pay nothing, right? So that has already been taken as for granted that this is a social transfer that the government has provided and education has provided. It's compulsory, it's free. But if... I use education only because it is a slightly controversial to suggest that we ever touch education spending. But then people will start to think, if I don't want to put so much more money into education, what are the areas in which I can cut down on? And then Singaporeans, as Pei Ling said, will decide. If I don't want to raise revenues, then let's cut. And if you want to cut, where are you willing to cut?
Yeah, so we need to really see the connection there, that changing one variable will affect another and think about what you're willing to accept. Ultimately, a lot of people still going back to the question of reserves. How much the full size of Singapore's reserves is not revealed. There are worries about currency attacks if that amount is revealed fully. But it's estimated at more than $1 trillion. So I think a lot of people are wondering, how much in reserves do you really need in order to feel secure for the future? The finance minister has explained that, you know, they are important. You can't just keep touching them and tap them out. But how much do you really need in those reserves? Why can't some of that money be used now to finance some of our needs?
Well, a few points. Firstly, I think just to give an illustration, yesterday during the roundup speech, in response to my colleague NMP Kwik Hsiao-yin, finance minister gave this in context. So with the amount of currency transaction around the world, actually our reserve is only but a small fraction of that. So I think what that is alluding to is also that even with our reserve currently, if there should be an attack on Singapore, even with our reserve, you know, nobody knows whether it will be enough. This is what I'm getting. But I think what's more important is actually the philosophy that we hold towards managing the reserve and how do we answer to the next generation. So in this case, if we always take the easy way out and we choose to draw down on the reserve, which, you know, in some sense is like drawing down on the principal, then it can become a slippery slope, and it become very tempting that every time if there's something, we keep drawing down on it, and then the principal will shrink, and then so will the whole pie and even the interest that the returns that we can get from it. So that is something that we need to really think about. Is this really what we want?
Better to be kiasu when it comes to safeguarding the reserves and not tapping into them so easily.
Yes, but it's also what our forefathers have been doing, and that's how we get to our position today. And as what was being said, it's very easy to just draw on it. But once we draw on it, and once it's gone, it will take many, many, many years to build it up again. And also the last point that I want to make is that it's not that the government has never drawn on the reserve before. When we were hit by the financial crisis, the economic crisis, we did draw on the reserves to cope, to fund a lot of the programs that we need to help the economy get back on track. In fact, we did quite well. We were least hit. But then after that, we had to put the money back in to the reserves again.
I think at the end of the day, this approach and philosophy towards the reserves is, I would say, quite a fundamental governing philosophy of the PAP government, right? From when it started to where it is now, so much so that even this is enshrined in the constitution, how it deals with the reserves. So in even suggesting to review that, obviously you hit quite a substantive block in the sense that the PAP does have very entrenched views on this. Yes, it has served us well over time.
Is it time for a review though, you think?
I think they have over time, to be fair. That's why these frameworks have changed over time. And yes, this is all part of the discussion that all political systems have to go to. But I think it's a bit unrealistic to expect such a fundamental shift from budget to budget.
No, of course not.
So you're not going to have
time for a review, perhaps, for the long term.
But the whole budget debate, if you see it in the totality, not just this year, but previous years, are all part of a review. Right? Who knows? At some point in time, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, maybe the discussion would have evolved in such a stage where they decide, yes, maybe we will see if we need to tweak it, right? But I don't think it's realistic to think that such a fundamental governing philosophy can be addressed from budget speech to budget speech from year to year. I think that's the approach I've taken, and so be it.
I'm sure all of you also noticed that the finance minister said that the 2 percentage point GST increase will in fact not fully cover our expenditure needs, but only make this fiscal gap more manageable in conjunction with other measures to manage expenditure. So, of course, I think this has led a lot of people to think, what are you saying? Meaning in a few years from now, there'll be more tax hikes, or there could be other tax hikes announced in the very, very near future, since he said that, you know, it doesn't really fully cover expenditure needs. What are the other levers? I mean, first of all, Pei-ling, your views on this. Is this a real possibility, you think, going forward in the next couple of years even?
I think looking at the projected demands or needs in various areas like healthcare, education, which were already being explained in the roundup speech, I think what he was trying to illustrate that even with this 2% increase in GST, it will only help to make the gap more manageable. And also saying that actually this is out of no choice also, that after all the trade-offs considered. Other measures will have to come in, including, I think, cost managing measures, growing the economy. So hopefully with the transformation, we will make it and that everyone will be much better off.
So not necessarily more and more tax hikes always.
Well, not necessarily, but we can never say never. I mean, to be realistic about this, no country dares to say that.
Mm. But what are the other levers you think that could be used in order to increase revenue? I mean, it surely can't only be GST, right? Yeah. There are other ways of increasing revenue. Maybe things like capital gains tax also need to be considered in the near future.
Well, I think the
things like increasing corporate tax and all that, in spite of the fact that there are trade-offs to that.
Certainly. So I think the government is not close to that idea. It's just that at this point in time, considering what's happening around us, how other countries such as US has responded in recent times. So after taking all this into account, the decision is as such as of now. But in future, things can change and so will the other measures. However, I think the one of the things in this year's budget that is new and probably something that is quite innovative is that the government has decided that for the major infrastructure projects that they will borrow, that they will borrow to fund these projects, and they see it as an investment. So it's not for recurrent spending, but it's for investment projects that will eventually yield a return and have impact, positive impact on the future generation. So this is diversifying the way we raise revenue to fund much necessary projects.
Okay, so those of you worried about GST hike every few years, don't be so worried. I would like to take this down further to the ground, specifically to your constituency, Pei Ling. You've got quite a large population of elderly, low income as well in your neighbourhood, and middle income, of course. How exactly are they responding to all of this?
In the first instance, when it was announced that there will be a GST hike, obviously everyone was very concerned, and it's very understandable because already on a day-to-day basis they are struggling with their everyday needs, and so they are worried about the impending increase in pressure again. But I also think that after explaining to those whom I've met, they have a better understanding of why it is, and the assurance that the government has given that there will be offset packages and increase in the permanent GST voucher does help to alleviate some of those concerns. So now it's really also for us on the ground to really observe and monitor and really get in touch with our people and see that moving forward, is there anything else we can do to help them manage better?
What are you going to say to angry people, though? I'm sure there's some angry people who come up to you and say, "What is this?"
Yeah, so actually, I have a really good...
Oh, no.
Wow, okay.
So no, but your constituent's very nice. Huh?
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, the thing about the elderly and maybe the slightly lower income, yes, they will get support in the GST vouchers and all that, but I wonder whether they see the direct relationship between GST increases and the GST voucher, in that that is precisely meant to address any raises in GST, because you do see a lot of arguments from people that, you know, the government should just exempt sort of daily necessities, for example, to offset the pain for the less well-off for GST. But the argument I can see from the government, as they say, is that the GST voucher actually does quite a bit to offset that exactly, and you don't need to do that. But I wonder whether people actually do see the direct link, whether they feel that this is it, you know what I mean? Or do they see the GST voucher as just a one-off, like the Hong Pao, and that, you know, this is it, I get to keep that, but then I still have to pay the GST.
Yeah, so some do, some don't. Even till now, we still have, I mean, I still get feedback from people comparing us with other countries. You know, they say that how come some other countries, even though they have like GST of 20%, but they exempt certain daily essentials. But I think this have been explained in Parliament and in different forums before. So let me...
It has to be targeted help, right? I mean, because if you exempt all daily essentials, even the rich will benefit from the exemptions.
Yeah. Exactly.
So in this case, it's very, very targeted help. The people who need it the most are getting it.
It is. In fact, with the offset packages and the permanent GST vouchers, the net effect is actually very similar. Mm. And when we talk about essential items, I think there is administrative challenges. So, for example, the question of what do you define as an essential item? What is essential to me may not be essential to you. Mm. And what brand or what type of that same essential item do you exempt it from? So, for example, if we look at the rice, which is a staple in our everyday diet. So there are different types of rice. We have the normal rice, we have the fragrant rice, we have brown rice, we have the Japanese pearl rice that are imported. And then what kind of brand? There's the house brand, like FairPrice house brand. We have the Flying Goldman, and then we have some more expensive brands as well. So which ones do we exempt? Are we making decisions on behalf of consumers? And then that's one question that we have to address. And then also, as you've mentioned, the well-off tend to consume more, and maybe even there will be some wastage as well.
Yeah, so again, it goes back to, is the government spending wisely, right?
Correct.
It all goes back to that, yeah, even in terms of the benefits and the packages it offers.
So we need to look at the net effect. But as Jamie has pointed out, sometimes when we are very caught up with everyday life, we don't really make that immediate connection. And I suppose this is where we really have to work harder on in terms of communicating and explaining. But explaining and communication alone is also not enough. We need to really make sure that the real impact, the real everyday life of our ordinary Singaporeans, we really help them solve their problems. If they really cannot cope, we must find ways to help them cope, even if it's not through government transfers. In the community, are we able to muster resources, rally the people to come together and help them offset? In my ward, we try to do some of that. And I'm sure in other constituencies, there are also similar programs to help that. So from our annual welfare day, our rations, our vouchers, our care funds, etc., we try to offset that pressure in different ways.
The aging population, of course, has been cited as the major reason that we have to also consider increased expenditure in terms of healthcare. And all of this, of course, includes not just the people who are currently old, but people who are younger and are progressing in age. So in fact, it affects all of us. And all this spending will go towards helping that group of people out as they get older. You have a large number of elderly in your constituency. How exactly are they perceiving all of this? How is all this discourse affecting them in their lives and their lived reality on a day-to-day basis?
Well, with all this talk about aging population and needs that come with the aging population, some of the elderly that we have come into interaction with are actually feeling a bit concerned. They feel that they are now under the spotlight and that everything that has been talked about is attributed to them. But it's actually not just them.
So we have to pay higher taxes because of them. It's their fault. Is that what others might be saying?
There's a lot of that narrative on the ground now, and it's I think a bit of a concern as well. But it's not just them; it's also for us in the future. But I think we need to have a paradigm shift, and this paradigm shift that needs to happen across all levels, all sectors, and all ages in the society. We need to stop thinking that just because we have become old, we are becoming useless. That's not true. Of course, there will be some physical constraints, maybe poorer eyesight, maybe the physical strength is not there anymore. But it doesn't mean that this person is less valuable, that this person cannot contribute anymore. So I think with age, there's a lot of experience and wisdom, and also the elderly tomorrow, that means us today, elderly tomorrow, we bring with us a lot of skills and we are exposed to a lot of things.
But is enough being done to capitalize on those strengths, you see, within society so that they too can be contributing members instead of being perceived as a burden on society?
Yeah, so I think not enough is being done. There's still a lot of ageism, especially at the workplace. And we really need a whole of society to come in and change this. The elderly who may choose to work. I've met elderly who wants to work because they cannot stand just staying at home. And there are, of course, elderly who choose to want to be volunteers. They want to continue to pursue their dreams, a lot of things. Mm. So let us help them. Let us create an environment that is actually enabling as opposed to disabling. So a lot of the policies, the work, the setup, the layout, the processes, even the benefits are actually designed for a younger population back in the older days. Mm. But now with this impending reality that our population landscape is evolving, let us also evolve along as well. For those who want to, because either they enjoy it or hopefully not out of financial need, since they want to, let us help them.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, even if it means doing volunteer work, which
even,
is a big contribution to society.
It is.
Just because you're not making money doesn't mean you're useless.
Many of my volunteers are actually elderly and they're wonderful. They can connect with the elderly. They love children and they are very, very dedicated. If not for them, a lot of things that we are doing actually cannot be done. Actually, more like 70% of my my volunteers are actually elderly themselves, and they enjoy it. You can see that sense of passion, that sense of meaning in life. They look forward to every day.
So what would you suggest needs to be done in the years ahead to introduce policies, and what types of policies do you think are needed, and what types of action do you think are needed on the ground as well from ordinary Singaporeans in order to empower this group of people. And this has to continue through the generations, eh? Because let's face it, it's not just the people who are currently elderly. Yeah. All of us will be affected by such policies and actions as well.
So I think there are various things that we can look at. So even like SkillsFuture, which I think is a good start, which embraces lifelong learning. Because in the past, a lot of the education-related subsidies or help are actually targeted to youngsters who are in school. But, I mean, what about adults who have already gone out to work? What about seniors who have retired but still have a thirst for new learnings, for new knowledge? And then, for example, at the workplace level, how do we redesign our work environment, the workflow, the common band? How do we make it more customized towards the needs of an elderly or a senior worker? So these are some of the examples that we can look at.
There are economic benefits to this as well. For the people who are listening now and saying, what's in it for me? The cold-hearted, you know, sort of mentality sometimes. There are economic benefits to doing all of these things, which could in turn affect each and every one of us, right?
Yes.
Even in terms of the amount of taxes we have to pay in the future.
Positively. Of course, I should clarify that by saying all this about making work environment more elderly friendly, it's not to say that therefore now elderly should work so that we can pay less taxes.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's not that. But
we need to clarify that.
Yeah, we need to clarify that, because there are elderly who really just enjoy working because it helps with their self-esteem, that sense of meaning in life, that they are still able to do things. And so we should recognize that and we should help them.
I think this is one issue where there's only so much that policy and government intervention can help with, because it's underlying so much of our own social philosophies and thinking as to what the role of an elderly person is and what they can do and can't do, and then therefore making provisions for that. And the very fact is, once people see that they're making extra provisions for that, there will be employers and there will be people out there who see this as a burden or an extra thing that they have to do. So I think, yes, governments and employers can do little bits and pieces.
I understand there are some grants and all that that are offered, grants that are offered to companies.
But until there really is a systemic sort of shift in our own thinking, as Peiling was saying, all these will help. But because the population is going to get larger, you do need a very fundamental shift in our thinking about them and about ourselves as well. Because, you know, the way it goes now, if you try and find a job or something for an elderly person to do, the automatic sort of default is that either A, it will be seen as menial or may even be menial, which is very unfortunate, right? Is there not a different way to look at it? It's a tough call, because at the same time, as Peiling was saying, if they do want to go out of work, you have to let them find opportunity to do so. But hopefully these jobs are also a bit value add, and we don't just go to the bottom of the list in that, okay, let's find you something to do, and it is the most sort of token type of job.
This comes from people just making sweeping generalizations about what the elderly are capable of. People are often not assessed based on their real competencies and their abilities. They're assessed based on age, sometimes gender and things like that. So we need to move away from that and be more neutral in terms of assessing a person's abilities.
In fact, I think as the economy evolves, we are looking at more high-value jobs. And as our generations mature, actually we are looking at every succeeding generation, they are better educated, more savvy with technology. Technology will be so much more entrenched in our lives. We're going to be relatively a lot more comfortable. So there are a lot of things that we can do. In fact, the jobs will be less reliant on manual labor, but more on intellect and wisdom. And these are actually to the advantage of senior workers. And even as of today, some of the residents that I met, elderly, retirees, they are actually PMETs. That, like, for example, there's this old gentleman. He's an engineer. And he actually doesn't want to retire because he still feels that he can contribute and he wants to do something. Because firstly, for him, he has a lot of experience that he should continue to pass on to the next generation. But it's also that it's also keeping him mentally active and physically active. Mm. In fact, some other elderly whom they have told me half in joke is that they are worried that if they stop, then their mind will stop and they're very worried about dementia. So there are elderly who actually enjoy doing what they do, and they are not necessarily those who are doing very laborious type of work. And for the elderly whom we have observe today who are doing the laborious type of work, like collecting dishes and collecting cardboards, I think we should do more to help them. But at the same time, we should also get to know them better. Some of them still have a very strong sense of dignity. And we have met once in a while when they will just nicely tell us, you know, I'm okay.
When you offer help, right?
Yes.
Financial help.
Yes. Yeah. So I think we need to strike a balance. But certainly, I think for those who are struggling, who need help, we should help them. Because those they have done so much for us.
Those who are struggling and genuinely need help, is enough being done to help those people once you find them, you think?
Of course, it depends on what is their situation. So I think first and foremost, usually, thankfully, they do have a proper place to live in. So it's really about their day-to-day expenses. So we have, for some of them, we will apply for the SSO, the longer-term financial assistance. And then there's also workfare if they are working, so that will supplement them. And then within the community, we have vouchers to offset some of their daily essentials. We have rations, we have McPherson. Okay, so at least
in my constituency,
we have something called a McPherson Care Fund to help to offset further their healthcare expenditure, etc. So we have quite a range, and it depends on what their needs are. And if they have children whom they are still supporting, then there's bursary, there's scholarships, a range. So I think these will, in different ways, help to relieve part of the pressure that they face. But of course, in the end, as much as these help are available, they need to consent to it as well.
Yeah. Let me ask you, where does the bulk of the McPherson Care Fund come from?
Oh, from donors. We actually go out to ask Singaporeans to donate. So we are thankful that actually so far we have been able to maintain this. Although it's not a very deep pocket, but we have been able to help a few hundreds, close to I think thousands of residents so far. So they will come, they will show us the medical expenses, and then we will help to offset the out-of-pocket portion after subsidies. And this MCF that we set up was because back then I've met residents, elderly who for example, there's this couple I still remember very vividly. This lady, her husband was lying on bed and cannot see the doctor, and she said, just let him die because I can't afford it. And I thought that was quite terrible. Yeah. But of course, there were subsidies that were helped, but I think they were not very aware. But that also prompted us to do something, to set up a fund to help them, but also to share with them what else are available, so that together, taken in totality, these will help to relieve their pressure, help them access the medical services that they need. But, you know, back to the point, actually, donors.
Are people more willing to give to charity than pay higher taxes?
Yes and no. Okay. We have met Singaporeans who, even though they pay high taxes, are still very happy to donate because they feel very strongly for the elderly or the poor and children. But there are also others who are less inclined, and therefore taxes is perhaps the only
necessary.
are these individuals and companies within McPherson or beyond as well? Because I mean, I'm thinking, it is interesting that private entities are donating, which is excellent to hear. And
so far, people in McPherson are quite warm and quite supportive. We have a lot of donors from outside of the ward. And actually, usually some of these donors are donating to a lot of different charities as
true,
well.
True. Yeah. So that's the other thing that has been emphasized in the budget, you know, the spirit of giving.
Yeah.
Volunteerism as well. Don't just give money, give time as well.
Definitely.
But I think we also have to bear in mind that in spite of all these help schemes and in spite of efforts going forward to empower the elderly, there are needs that need to be met for the elderly population going forward. More healthcare needs, nursing care, old age care, palliative care, all of these things will still be needed. How can these services be made more efficient? And how can spending be made more cost efficient on all of these services for the future? Well, what's the scope like?
Well, actually, to me, I think the government is actively looking into all of this. But what needs to step up more is actually that last mile, the human touch. Because the government can put in more subsidies, they can build more hospitals, which they are. They can try to hire more healthcare professionals. But The human touch is the one that I think is most critical. So what do I mean by that? I think if more Singaporeans can give more of our time to volunteer, we can achieve a lot. Even if it's just 2 hours per week, if every one of us does that, you know, the amount of work that we can accomplish. So actually in the community, for example, the elderly, they have access to healthcare services, they have access to social workers, medical workers and caregivers. However, sometimes small things like going to see a doctor, they need someone to accompany them, or you know, to run some errands for them, or just someone to talk to them. If we have more people who can step in, we can actually reach out to a lot more people.
See, it definitely goes beyond money, beyond yes. monetary contributions. And that's something I think we all need to be a little cognizant of as well.
Yeah.
Any closing comments, Jamie?
Well, one of the things which we were talking about is how, before we started recording, was how a lot of our mature estates, right, you were mentioning, weren't necessarily designed
for
the people who are still yes. living there. And how a lot of these can be improved. And I think there have been some efforts made to look into that in newer estates. But I think by and large, I think design is a big issue.
Definitely.
I think we need to do a bit more design that is timeless as well as able to stand the test of whoever's using it, whether you are 10 or 80.
Mm.
And I think that's where a lot of the problems come in, where you have older estates and older neighborhoods that can't accommodate the people that are living there now.
Mm. Although I should interject also, just to be fair, is that actually there are also some retrofitting initiatives, like
yeah,
for example
within the homes as well,
within
right?
the homes and in the community, like City yeah. for All Ages. For the more mature estates, there are some efforts to try to retrofit, but of course yeah. retrofit is not as good as if you design right from the beginning with yeah. them in mind.
Mm.
Yeah. So we should design to include and empower as opposed to design just for a specific.
To accommodate, yeah.
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 Mm. In fact, several business people have told me that the best way to go forward is to design everything with only the elderly in mind, because the young can easily adapt to that, you know.
Yes.
For instance, if you're going to put larger fonts on your packaging, the young are not going to complain about that, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So you might as well just yeah. design everything for the elderly in mind. Closing comments from you, Pei Ling. The next few weeks, I'm sure there'll be more talk about the budget. What's your message to Singaporeans?
Well, I think it is important that we continue to look at the big picture and how to ensure that Singapore will continue to succeed, because the competition around us is very keen. So the first and foremost is to help Singapore transform and continue to succeed in the years ahead. So that's first and foremost. Secondly, I think it's important that we continue to keep an eye on the lives of ordinary Singaporeans, to make sure that we don't leave anyone behind. And so whether it's from policies to financial assistance or the way we design things, we must make sure that it is inclusive. And this is an effort that we must never let down. And lastly, I think at the end of the day, no matter how noble schemes, plans, visions may be, in the end, we need the support of Singaporeans.
Mm.
So if without the support of Singaporeans, we would not be able to achieve. And whatever we say in the international global arena, we'll have no power, we have no weight.
Mm.
So Singaporeans continuing to work together is important. But of course, at the same time, this trust must not be taken lightly. And so the government will have to continue to work very hard to deliver on promises to make sure that Singaporean lives is improved.
Mm.
Then together, I think we will have a very hopeful and optimistic future to talk about.
Yeah, because the buy-in is important. Fulfilling those promises, very, very important as well.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for joining me, guys. My guests today were Tin Pei Ling. She's Member of Parliament for Macpherson and Chief Editor of Channel News Asia's Digital News Desk, Jamie Ho. Thanks for listening to us on The Pulse.